talking about indirect exchange and specialization. Before I dive into the main lecture, let me just make a general announcement to remind you guys. If you're taking this class for credit, keep in mind that I guess it will be after next week, we're going to have a midterm, right? Because there's 10 weeks total, and so after the fifth week, we'll have a midterm. So you'll have a regular quiz this week, but then after week five, there'll be a midterm. So I just want to give you a heads up on that. So it'll just be, in addition to doing your quiz, there'll be a midterm. And so I'll give you more details on that next week, but I just kind of want to bring that up to make sure you are aware that that's coming. The other thing is I traveled a lot last week, and so I fell behind the schedule as far as getting the high-quality videos out, so there might be a lag of a week or two until we get back on track, but we will catch up with that, all right? But I just wanted to acknowledge that I'm behind on those. Okay, so moving ahead for today's lecture, we're going to be talking about, first, indirect exchange. And here, let me talk about the drawbacks of direct exchange, and then that'll just naturally pave the way for why we use indirect exchange. So the drawbacks of direct exchange, I mean, first of all, direct exchange is great compared to nothing. And so in the previous lecture, when we went over the simple example of the Halloween candy, what we saw that illustrated the general principle that two parties in a voluntary exchange both benefit. And again, just repeating myself here, the reason that's possible is that value in economics is subjective, that it's in the eye of the beholder, and so that's why there are gains from trade, that two people can swap things and walk away, and each person thinks that he or she got the better end of the deal, but gave up the thing that was less valuable and obtained the thing that was more valuable, because value, to repeat, is not an objective property of objects. It is related to their objective properties, but it's ultimately your subjective opinion or expectation of how useful that thing will be to you and how it will help you satisfy your subjective ends. So direct exchange is great, but there's limitations on it. And the most obvious thing is that what happens when you go out and you want to sell something, trade something away, and you want to obtain something else, well, you need to find, under direct exchange, you need to find somebody who has the exact opposite valuations as you do and has the other thing. So standard examples, people say things like, under direct exchange, if that's all that were permissible, then it would be hard for someone to become a dentist because that person, in order to eat, would need to find people who had food and at that same moment had a toothache and needed the dentist's services and then were willing to offer food in exchange for them. Right? And so you see the, if you were limited to direct exchange, again, that would be much better than nobody interacting with each other, no trade at all, but it would be very limited, and you wouldn't have people going into separate occupations. Everybody would still probably have to do most of their things on their own. Everyone would have to grow his own food, make his own clothes, and so on, and then just occasionally people might trade their surpluses here and there, but you really couldn't... you couldn't plan on it, put it that way, because things would be very uncertain. Again, especially for things like being a dentist or being a school teacher, for example. If you just think through that and what would it mean to try to be a school teacher under a regime of just direct exchange where everybody has to directly use the things that they're obtaining in the exchanges, you would have to find a family, families that wanted education for their kids, and then one household would have to give you food, and another household would have to give you clothes, and so forth. okay, and then every semester or every school year, you would have to have a new incoming batch of students with those various characteristics, that the one student's family at least came from a family of farmers, and that's where you're going to get your food from teaching that kid. And then somebody else would have to come from a family that made clothes for a living, and that's where you were going to get your clothes from, by teaching that kid. And, you know, other people that made buggies that were drawn by horses, and that's where you get your transportation from. And so if any, you know, in a particular year, if there were no farmers' kids that needed education that year, well, then you would starve if you were a school teacher under direct exchange. Okay, so that's one way of seeing how limited things would be. And the answer, and you know, what would happen is that you wouldn't have school teachers, or at least you wouldn't have that as a dedicated occupation. Instead, you would just have maybe people occasionally would teach a class on the side, as it were, but you wouldn't have somebody whose career was being a school teacher. Instead, they would have to, no, most of their time they would be growing food in their backyard and making and sewing their own clothes and building their own house, that kind of stuff, because, again, you wouldn't have that regular market. All right, so that's a main drawback. Another one to push the analysis a little bit more is, not only could you not have specialized occupations, but you also couldn't have business enterprises. Because if you think about what happens in a business enterprise, the same sort of thing, that they're hiring various types of workers and they're buying all sorts of different resources, and then they make something and sell it to somebody else. And if you had to do that so that every single person involved in all the transactions was directly going to use the thing they were receiving, it would be really complicated. So for example, just think about a home builder, right? So all the kind of stuff that goes into being a home builder as your occupation, or as your you know, the industry you're in, you would have to get a bunch of different workers, people who are plumbers and mechanics and carpenters and things like that, just regular manual laborers, all those different people. And then when you paid them, you would have to pay them in tuna fish and in bottled water and in milk and in bread and that kind of stuff, or in sweaters that they were going to take home and wear or give to their kids maybe. Right, so you would have to pay them in all the things that they directly wanted to use. And the same thing for the people who were going to sell you the lumber. You would have to give them food or clothing or so forth. And then once you built the house, I mean, even there, it's not clear. If you sold it to somebody else, that already we might be leaving the realm of direct exchange. But put that aside, even if you grant an exemption to the entrepreneur, when you went to sell the house, you'd have to find somebody who was going to give you, you know, a 30-year supply of food or something. You know, they couldn't give you something that you were then going to trade away for something else. All right, so you can just see there's no way you would have large-scale enterprises going on where there was a lot of capital investment and a lot of, in our terminology, like a lot of money involved in the business and a lot of overhead and fixed costs, those sorts of things that are characteristic of a modern market economy. You couldn't have that under direct exchange. It just wouldn't work. All right, so that's another major thing. So you can't have specialized occupations, and then the business side, you can't do it that way. Just, again, coordinating with all the different people on both sides of the transaction, it wouldn't work if everybody had to just be willing to accept the things directly. And then one last issue is there could be no accounting, right? That there'd be no single common denominator of how you would price everything. So if you were running an operation and you had all, you know, let's say you were trying to decide if what you were doing made sense, like you're taking in a bunch of inputs like lumber and glass and so on, and you're building houses, the way in a modern market economy, the way you understand if you're turning a profit, if you're doing well, if what you're doing makes economic sense, is you want to see, is the value of the stuff I'm selling, is that more than the market value of the resources I'm using up? And so in order to do that, you have to convert it to numbers. You want to say something like, well, I'm making $100,000 in sales this year and my expenses were $90,000, so yeah, that's $10,000 in profit. Okay, that's the kind of way you want to reason. But if instead you were looking at physical things and you were saying, well, I have, I used 30 tons of lumber and I used this many pounds of glass and I used 15,000 hours worth of manual labor and da-da-da-da-da, and then I sold 18 houses or whatever, you know, it's, there's no way you would compare both of those and then be able to say, does this make economic sense? You'd have no idea, okay? So I'm just showing you all the different reasons that actually indirect exchange is very useful. So what is indirect exchange? I'll define it first just to make sure we remember that, and then I'll talk about this diagram. Indirect exchange going to trade it away in the future. And let me, I think I mentioned this last week, but let me say it again just to make sure you get this subtle point. It's not that indirect exchange is not about you consuming the thing. All right, so when we were talking about a consumption good versus a production good or a factor of production, remember we were saying that if the thing directly gives me utility, then it's a consumption good. Whereas if it indirectly gives it to me, then it's either a capital good or a natural resource or something like that. Okay, that's not the distinction we're making here. Okay, so an indirect exchange, just to try to be clear here, you can receive a production good in an indirect exchange or even in a direct exchange. All right, so again, a direct exchange is not limited to consumption goods. The issue is when you're trying to decide, is it a direct exchange or an indirect exchange, you need to figure out, is the person accepting the thing because he's going to use it, or is he just accepting it because he's going to trade it away? And that's the issue. So if a farmer, let's say there's two farmers, and one of the farmers gives eggs and the other one gives an axe to the other guy, that it could be a direct exchange, right? Because the one farmer is going to eat the eggs and the other farmer is going to take the axe and then start chopping down trees on his property and build a fence, let's say. Okay, so that's a direct exchange, even though one of the items doesn't give direct happiness, right? The reason that the one farmer valued the axe wasn't because he was going to eat it or because he was going to look at it as a piece of art. No, it was going to be a tool that he was going to use to achieve some other end. So he was going to use it indirectly, as it were, to bring him happiness, to, you know, keep his cows and his property because he puts the fence up or whatever. Whereas the other farmer, you know, those eggs were consumption goods because he was going to eat them and they were going to directly confer happiness. So there, that was a direct exchange, even though one of the sets of goods was not a consumption good. Okay, so I just want to be clear about that issue. Okay, so let's now talk about this diagram a little bit. And I had to pull it up on my PowerPoint to enlarge it. So here, I just want to make sure you understand what's going on in this picture. This is going along with the text, and we've got three different people, a farmer, a butcher, and the cobbler. And make sure you understand how their preferences work. These are, again, are listing things first, second, third. Okay, so the guy who walks into town, the farmer, these are their preferences for direct use. Okay, so if they weren't thinking about exchange at this point, so the farmer, you know, what he really cares about is getting repaired shoes. Then the next thing he cares about is eggs, and the third thing is bacon. And the butcher, what he really values is having some eggs. Then the next thing is bacon, and lastly, the repaired shoes. Okay, and so on for the cobbler. So you can see here is in terms of direct exchange, if we only allow these three guys to trade with each other such that for any particular trade, both parties were going to directly use the thing they got, then there would be no scope for trade here. Okay, so let me just say that in different words. These three people with these preferences, and then starting out where the farmer starts out with the eggs, the butcher starts out with the bacon, and the cobbler starts out with his ability to repair shoes, his labor power. If you put these three people in a room and said you're only allowed to do direct exchanges, there's nothing they could do. So, for example, I'm not going to go through all of it, but let's say the farmer and the butcher, they're trying to interact. Is there any way they could both make a trade and both be happier? No, they can't, because the farmer has eggs and the butcher has bacon. And so the butcher would be happy to trade the bacon for the eggs, right? Because the butcher values the eggs more highly than the bacon. So he'd be willing to trade, but the farmer wouldn't, because on the farmer's preferences, the eggs are higher than the bacon. So the farmer would say, nah, I'd rather just keep my eggs than trade them for your bacon if that's what I'm going to eat. All right, so there's no gain there. We'll do one other one just to make sure you see the pattern. What about the butcher and the cobbler? Well, they interact, and the cobbler says, yeah, I would definitely like to take your bacon in exchange for giving up my leisure, meaning I will work on your shoes using my cobbling services, and so I will, in a sense, be giving up my leisure time because I'm going to be working. But in my value scale, yeah, if you're going to give me your bacon, I'll definitely repair your shoes. But the baker or the butcher says, nah, in my preferences, the bacon I value more highly than repairing my shoes. So I'd rather just keep my shoes the way they are and keep my bacon. Okay, so there's no gain from trade there. But what does happen is if all three of them get together and we could somehow magically just have them all agree to, you know, shift their goods going leftward, let's say, and just move and rearrange everything, then it would work. So in particular, if the cobbler repairs the shoes of the farmer, if the farmer hands his eggs over to the butcher and the butcher hands his bacon over to the cobbler, then all three of them end up happier than they were originally. They've all moved up on their value scales. Okay, but the crucial thing is that complicated scenario couldn't happen if you just limited it to any one trade at a time, right? If each step of the transactions had to be advantageous for both participants, you could never get to that outcome, even though we've just shown if somehow we could make it so that the cobbler would repair the shoes of the farmer would hand the eggs over, and the butcher would hand the bacon over, they would all be better off. So if you didn't know anything about market economics and how economies work in the real world, you know, you could imagine somebody saying that that was like a that you needed the government to come in, right? Because doesn't that seem kind of complicated? Like, well, how in practice could that work? How could you get this complex thing going on where everybody does something that temporarily makes him worse off, but he knows somebody else is going to, like, return the favor? See what I'm saying? You can imagine somebody who didn't know anything about capitalism or market economies saying this sort of situation proves that we need government or socialism or something, because there's situations like this where you have to temporarily act against your interest, sort of, you know, take a step back in order to go two steps forward. Let me just say it. I'm probably beating a dead horse here, but I want to make sure you guys understand what I'm getting at, that if you didn't know anything about how trading works and how markets work, this sort of situation where no two people one-on-one have a voluntary trade that makes sense, and yet if they all collectively did something, they would all be better off. That superficially looks like a situation where markets don't work, because it looks like there has to be this coordination and the people myopically just focusing on their own situation might, you know, be real selfish and say, no, I'm not going to give you, you know, the farmer says, I'm not going to give up my eggs to the butcher because I don't want what he's got. And I don't know if the cobbler's going to come and return the favor, so why would I go out on a limb and do that? And so if they're all acting like that, well, then nothing happens. Okay, so you see the issue there. So now the question is, okay, in the real world, how do markets address that? We know if there are gains from trade one-on-one, people would just trade, and that's what direct exchange is. But how do we deal with this sort of issue under indirect exchange? Well, it's because people can look ahead and understand what other people are willing to trade for. So, for example, in this example, the farmer can realize, if the farmer realizes that the cobbler likes bacon and that would be willing to repair the farmer's shoes for bacon, then when the farmer bumps up against the butcher who's willing to trade bacon for his eggs, the farmer does it, okay? Because there what's happening is he's now valuing the bacon not for its direct use to him, but for its exchange value, because he realizes, oh, wait a minute, I can use this bacon now to trade with the cobbler and acquire a set of repaired shoes. All right, so let me just say that again in different words because it's kind of an important point. Once people are trading things, and that becomes standard, then people start broadening their horizons. They start looking at goods and evaluating them, not merely on account of their own direct use for them, whether they're consumption goods or production goods, but now they start looking at them as exchange goods. They start saying, if somebody offers something to trade for the thing that you're starting out with, when you're considering, do I want to make this trade, you're thinking, first of all, could I directly use that? But then you're also thinking, well, even if I don't want to use it personally, is there anybody else in the community that really wants this thing? And then do I want the stuff I could get for it in trade? All right, so just like, just to give you an exaggerated example maybe to make the point, if you were in prison, let's say, and people were using cigarettes as a sort of money, and that apparently happens in prisons, that even if you were a non-smoker and somebody says, hey, you know, and I don't know what skill you would have, like let's say you tell funny jokes or something, and someone says, hey, can you tell me some funny jokes? I'll give you a cigarette for it. Even if you don't want to smoke, you might do it because then you know that somebody else who has, I don't know what, candy bar or something or a book you want would give you that thing for a cigarette. Okay, and so there you would be willing to tell your jokes and get the cigarette, again, not because you're a smoker, but because you know that that thing is valued by some people in the little trading community you're in. Okay. Or, I mean, just give you a different example. If, I don't know, if you're like at a county fair or something and you do well throwing the baseball and knocking down the pins, and then you win the prize, and the guy says, okay, you get to choose between these things, and he shows you, you know, a big stuffed bear, and then he shows you a poster or something of some rock group, and you're trying to say, if you don't want the things personally, but you realize that one of them is something that your best friend wants and would trade you for, or that you could resell on eBay and get something else for it, you might pick the thing that you know has a higher value, even though you personally can't stand that band. Something like that, like especially if it's an autographed poster by some musician like Taylor Swift or something. Even if you can't stand Taylor Swift, if that's one of the items, or you get to pick like a teddy bear that's not special, you might pick the Taylor Swift photo again because you know you could sell to somebody else, that you know there are some people that really value that thing. Okay, so that's the essential insight in how indirect exchange begins, and so that's what indirect exchange is. Again, it's you're accepting something not for its usefulness directly to you, but because you're going to trade it away again. And when that happens, let's give you a definition here. The good that is being accepted with the intention of then trading it away again for something else, that good is called a medium of exchange. All right, so that that terminology is a little bit quaint or obsolete now. People don't really talk like that. But that word medium, it doesn't mean, it means something that's in between. So just like, you know, there's low, medium, and high, and, you know, so the medium's kind of in between or in the middle. That's the sense it means here. You may have heard, you know, people saying that air is a medium through which sound waves travel. Or that's also what we talk about the media, right? So if you think about it, what's the news media or, you know, the TV media or print media, in that context, what we mean is that's the intermediate group, right? So some news event happens somewhere, and then how do you learn about it in your home is you it gets filtered to you through the media, right? So they're the means through which the outside news comes to you. And so in economics, in this context, what do we mean by a medium of exchange? We mean it's the good through which the ultimate exchange happens. So looking at this example again on this slide, the farmer trades his eggs to the butcher gives his bacon to the farmer, and then the farmer gives the bacon to the cobbler to get the shoes repaired. In that process, the bacon is a medium of exchange. Because in a sense, what the farmer really did is he traded away his eggs and received shoe repair services. Okay, but he didn't do that directly, right? He had to go through the bacon. And so the bacon was a medium through which his ultimate transaction occurred. Okay, so that's where that term medium of exchange is coming from. Okay, so that's, I think, pretty simple when I explain it like that, and you can see the logic behind it, and you can see how that begins to overcome the limitations on direct exchange. But what's interesting is once you have that down, you can generalize it pretty easily and see the Austrians' theory of where money came from. So before I jump into that, let me just make sure define what money is. In the Austrian approach, and other economists would endorse this definition, what money is a medium of exchange that is generally accepted in the community. And so I'll say that again. The definition of money, if you say what really is money, it is a medium of exchange that everybody in the community or the vast majority of the community accepts. So what that means in practice is when people are trying to trade, everybody in the community is willing to sell what they're giving away and receive the money commodity in exchange for that. And then they go out and spend the money on the thing they're ultimately trying to get. All right, so... And it's, remember, don't, at this stage in the analysis, don't think of money as dollar bills or as, you know, euros, wherever you live. Don't think of it as pieces of paper. Think of it as things like cigarettes or bars of gold, because historically, money originally was actual commodities in the marketplace that became money. They evolved into money. And it's easier to think of it that. And then later on, what happened is... governments linked those things to paper and then severed the link, and then people now just use paper. But historically, gold or real goods emerged as money from the marketplace. Okay, so again, what I'm trying to stress is what is money? What's the essence of money? It is something that everybody is willing to accept on one side of the transaction. So just like in that last example, the farmer gave away his eggs and received the bacon in exchange for that, even though he didn't want the bacon directly because he was going to trade it away. So there, he was willing to accept the bacon as a medium of exchange. So what is money? It is a commodity in a particular community where everybody who's you know, in the market to do something, they want to get rid, trade away some things and obtain other things, they are perfectly happy to trade away their stuff in exchange for this one particular item. And if that one particular item is accepted by everybody, then it's money. All right, so let me clarify. A medium of exchange is not necessarily money. Okay? Well, all money is a medium of exchange. All right, so again, what a money is, it's a medium of exchange, but it has to be accepted by everybody. So in that last example there, we can't say that that bacon was money in that community, because we don't know that everybody would have accepted bacon. All right, especially if we start looking at more and more people who are in that community. If there are people, you know, fishermen or whatever, who want to trade away their excess catch of fish and they want to obtain butter, and then somebody says, well, hey, I'll give you some bacon for your fish, and then they might say, nah, because I can't be sure that there are people with butter out there who want bacon, so I'm not taking it. Well, then, oops, bacon's not money in that community. Okay, so to be a money, a thing has to be a medium of exchange, and then on top of that, it's got to be a medium of exchange that every single person, basically, is willing to accept when they're trading away their stuff. Okay, so that's so it's a medium of exchange with this extra requirement, namely that it's accepted by everybody. Okay, so and that also incidentally means you can have indirect exchange before there's a money. And so originally you just had direct exchange. Then when various people start accepting things, not that they're going to directly use, but they want to trade away, now you've got indirect exchange happening, but you still don't have money. In these early stages of the development, not every single person is willing to accept the same thing as a medium of exchange, and so you don't have money yet. It's only when indirect exchange has been going on for a while until finally every single person is willing to accept the same thing as a medium of exchange, then that thing now is money. Okay, so there's a gradual evolution there where you go from direct exchange to indirect exchange, and then finally money will emerge. Okay. So why don't I explain to you now how exactly does that happen? So we've seen how it's very simple to go from direct exchange to indirect exchange. Right? All you need is to see the limitations, like the three-person diagram we had before, where there's gains from trade if things could be rearranged, you know, more than just one at a time or two at a time. And you can see how all it takes is somebody being able to look one step ahead, and then indirect exchange is born and the practice begins. But now, how do you go from that to one commodity becoming a money so that every single person accepts the same thing? So this theory of how that could happen was actually developed by Karl Menger, who was the founder of Austrian economics in 1871. So if, you know, this isn't like an Austrian bragging point. I mean, if you go and look in standard history of economic thought books or whatever, you know, when it comes to the origin of money, Menger is cited as a pioneer in this development. Okay, so what Menger said is, he said, okay, let's go back to the time when you had people engaging in indirect exchange, but there was no money yet. And he said, now, even at this early stage, some things would be a lot more marketable than others. So that, you know, some goods that you could accept, you would realize there would be a wide market for them. And the other goods, it wouldn't be such a wide market. And so an example would be like a telescope that you're going to use to look at distant objects in the sky. Certain people would be willing to trade a lot for that thing. So it has a high market value, but the point is not many people want a telescope. And so its market would be very limited. All right. Or in contrast, something like eggs or bacon, a lot of people in the community presumably would want those things. And so if you had some eggs or bacon, you wouldn't have a hard time unloading it, finding somebody on the other side of the transaction who had what you did want. Okay, so that's the idea. And so what Menger said is, in that environment, what people naturally do is if they have something that's less marketable or less liquid, if you know that terminology, and they can't find someone who has exactly what they want, well, then they go ahead and give up the thing they have in exchange for something else, as long as that other thing is more marketable. All right, so it's, you're just moving closer to your ultimate objective. So there, Menger's just explaining how indirect exchange happens, right? Because that's what indirect exchange is. You give up what you have to obtain something, not because you want to use it yourself, but because you're going to then trade it away. Right, so that's indirect exchange. But now the point is that process starts to snowball, because when you ask what sorts of things are people going to be willing to accept as media of exchange, right, where media is the plural of medium. So initially they might accept all kinds of different things. But so over time, you know, people are going to have a preference, other things equal, to accept things that have a bigger market, that are more marketable. Right, so if you have a telescope and you're like, oh man, this thing, how am I ever going to find someone who wants a telescope? And you come, so that occasionally when you do come across someone who has a telescope, who wants a telescope, then you say, oh, thank goodness, what do you give me for this? And the person might say, oh, wow, that telescope's amazing. I've been looking for one of these things for years. Well, you know, I can give you a bunch of butter, or I can give you some bricks. What do you want? Well, the person might say, why don't you give me the butter? Because I'm much more likely to find someone who wants the butter than the bricks. Even though both of those things are more marketable than this telescope, if you're giving me the choice, I'd rather take the butter. Okay, and then, or, you know, if you happen to see two people who wanted the telescope, and the one guy said, well, I can give you a bunch of butter, and the other guy said, I can give you a bunch of bricks, you know, other things equal, he would have a preference to sell it to the guy with the butter. Okay, so the point is, once this process happens, the things that start out with a bigger market, that are more marketable, just because of more people want to use them in their direct use, they then gain an advantage. Now, when people start accepting things for their indirect exchange value, they have a preference for the things that already were marketable to begin with. And so it just augments the superior marketability of the things that already had an advantage. Okay, so let me just say that again in different words. If you start out in a situation of direct exchange, there are some goods that have a bigger market than others. There are some things that more people want to use, as opposed to other goods that have a very narrow market. There are very few people during any time period who are going to want that thing in exchange for their own personal use. And so now when we move into indirect exchange, the people, and people start accepting things as stepping stones, that they trade away what they have, they want to get rid of, and they start accepting things just as a means to an end to obtain what they really want. Now, part of what their selection process is they, when they're considering making a trade, they say, well, this thing that I'm being offered, how big is the market for it? And so now, more people in the community start accepting this particular item, if it originally was marketable to begin with. And so you see that the things that were very marketable in the first place now become even more marketable, because even, you know, just to give you an example, suppose 95% of the people in the community eat butter and the other 5% don't, that they think butter is disgusting. Well, the people who don't eat butter will accept it now because they know there's a 95% chance whatever it is they want, there's going to be somebody in the community who wants butter and has that thing, because so many people use butter and directly. Okay, so now instead of butter being acceptable to 95% of the community, it's acceptable to 100%, because even that 5% who don't use it are willing to accept it and trade because it started out with such a big market. So you see how the marketability of the most marketable things gets augmented. Now, the marketability per se is not the only thing going on. There's lots of other issues too that a good money will have. So butter actually, even though it might have a wide market, isn't really, there's a lot going against it, that if it's a really hot day, you know, it might melt on you. It's, you'd have to have a lot of it for big purchases. Like if you're going to sell a cow in exchange for butter, you'd probably have to ask for a lot of butter, right? And so there's issues like that. And so that's why, in practice, the precious metals, gold and silver, markets tended to home in on those things as the money. But the point is, generally, you know, how does money emerge? It's when this snowballing process finally culminates in just one or a few items that started out as being very marketable. Their marketability just kept getting bigger and bigger as more and more people kept accepting them. And again, the process just snowballs. So that by the end of it, there's one or two or three commodities that everybody in the whole community has no qualms about accepting when they're trying to get rid of stuff. And then they use that good to then go buy what they want. And that's what money is. Okay, so that's maybe one way of thinking about what is it that we do with money. Money sort of breaks up our transactions into two parts. And so first what we do is we sell the stuff that we're trying to get rid of, and we obtain a bunch of money for it, as much money as we can. And then we go out and try to buy the stuff we want with the money, and we want to pay as low a price as possible because we want to get the most stuff as possible with the money that we have. And so there we've sort of broken up the transactions. So again, that's what money is, and it's originally money was not pieces of paper. Money was physical things that were goods in the community valued directly, and then once indirect exchange started, people began to accept certain items more precisely because they were so marketable, and that just snowballed until finally one or two or three or whatever goods everybody accepted, and that's what money is. Okay, so we've explained how money emerges, even though you might have thought beforehand that it would take some wise, benevolent king to invent it. And no, just step by step, once you think it through that way, it's almost, you can almost see like it would be impossible for money not to emerge. But of course money would emerge. It's just a very natural byproduct of people trying to trade to their advantage. Okay, so now moving on, division of labor. This is something that on the one hand is obvious, but on the other hand is actually kind of subtle, like once you try to think through why it's true. So what we see with the division of labor is that there's, what we mean by that is what's called specialization, right? So the term division of labor, where that's coming from, it means we take a given amount of tasks that need to be done, certain amount of labor, and we divide it up. So it's not that every single person does every single type of thing. Everybody doesn't grow his own food, make his own clothes, build his own car, pull his own teeth. Instead, we divide the labor up. And so as a small group of the population grows all the food, and we call those guys farmers. And another small group of the people pulls all the teeth, and they're dentists. And another small group of people does all the teaching, and they're the teachers or the professors. And another group, you know, makes the clothes and so forth, and they're the tailors or the people who work in the factories in the garment industry, whatever. All right, so you get the idea. And so that's, on the one hand, that's so obvious and natural to us that we don't even remark on it usually. But if you think about it, that is sort of interesting. Why do we do that? Why is it that certain people specialize in teaching economics, and other people specialize in looking at physical theories, and other people are tremendous athletes, and other people are musicians? And part of it we can see, you know, intuitively, well, of course that makes sense. It would be crazy if Albert Einstein tried to start for the Bulls, or if Sheryl Crow tried to teach economics. That would be awful, right? So we get why that would be crazy, but it's worthwhile to just probe it further and try to see what's going on. Why is it the case that we have people who specialize, and so that, you know, they each go into their own occupations? So what's happening here is the productivity of labor goes up because of specialization or because of the division of labor. And so, loosely speaking, when people specialize, when they go into, you know, when we divide up the tasks that need to be done, and we have some people who concentrate on making music, and some people who concentrate on playing sports, and some people who drive race cars, and if I just offended you because you think NASCAR is a sport, I apologize. Other people who specialize in teaching people other people specialize in operating on brains and so on. Why do we do that? Why is that useful? Well, it's because people's labor is far more productive doing it that way rather than everybody doing everything, right? So there's more music that can be made, and there's more food that can be grown, and there's higher quality professional sporting events that we can all watch, and there's fewer people dying on the operating table and so on because we do it that way. And so what that means is that, in a sense, the amount of total stuff that's made on Earth every day is much higher because we divide the tasks up than if compared to the situation where we didn't do that. Okay, so that's the general principle or pattern, but now the question is, okay, but why is that the case? What is it? So in the textbook, I gave you five general reasons or factors because that makes that happen. And this isn't supposed to be an exhaustive list, and actually some of these things might overlap a little bit, but I just was trying to give you a general idea to make sure you're getting the picture and you're understanding what's going on here. Because again, it's so obvious to us that that's what people do that sometimes you kind of need to step back and pretend you didn't know that. That if you were had no history or experience with how modern society works, you might not think that people would specialize and each would just focus on his own task. In fact, you might think that that's boring and uncivilized, right? It seems like, well, no, people should diversify, and you know, I'll dabble a little bit in farming, and I'll make some clothes, and I'll do this. That, you know, if it weren't for this issue of the productivity of labor, how much stuff you could produce per hour being far higher when you divide the tasks up, then yeah, maybe you would think that everyone should try his or her hand at various tasks, so we all kind of, you know, get a feel for what everybody does, and we're all sort of bonded together like that instead of just focusing on our own little sphere of the world and not knowing what anybody else does, right? So you could see that mentality, but again, if we did try to do that right now, 95% of the world would die, and so that's why we don't do that, or that's a good reason not to do that, because there wouldn't be enough food grown if we switched back to that kind of system. Okay, so again, why, we're just trying to give some reasons here. Why is it that the productivity of labor, meaning how much stuff can you produce per hour of work, and remember, stuff can be a service, like somebody writing a song, that can be output too. We're not just meaning material, physical things. Why is it that how much you can produce per hour is so much higher when we divide the tasks up, when we specialize? Why is that? Okay, so one reason is it cuts down on switching time. And so here, the example I gave in the textbook, just to motivate this, to make sure you see what I'm saying, I think it was with kids cleaning up after dinner. So if the parents say, you know, the parents made the dinner, and then the job of the kids, and let's say there's three kids, and it's the job of the kids to clean up the kitchen after the meal's over, well, it's possible that the way that works is each kid picks up a dish from the table, walks over to the sink, turns the water on, puts it under, you know, rubs the sponge on it with the soap, rinses it off, walks to the right, picks up the towel, dries it off, moves to the right again, opens the cabinet. Okay? So I don't know when that got cut off, but the point is, if you didn't know any better, you might think that the way kids are going to clean up the dishes is each one picks up a dish, walks the sink, rinses it, moves to the right, dries it, moves to the right, puts it away, keeps going, you know, clockwise around the kitchen back to the table. And that when all was said and done, each of the kids would have put away roughly one-third of the dishes. You know, well, on average, they definitely would have. Some might have done one more or less, depending on how many dishes you started out with on the table. Okay, so that, if you didn't know any better, you might think that's how it should go. But in practice, I've never seen anyone clean up the dishes like that. In practice, what happens is people specialize. And it doesn't even take direction. Like, they just automatically do it. That somebody camps out in front of the sink, gets the water going. Somebody else focuses on moving the dirty dishes from the table to the sink, and maybe they also scrape it off, depending on how many people you got involved in the operation. And then somebody else takes the clean dishes and dries them and, you know, puts them away. And that's what they do. So they're handing the dishes to each other. They're not all walking around the room. So if you're trying to understand why is it that people naturally do it that way, as opposed to all moving around the kitchen counterclockwise, you can say, well, one obvious reason is the switching time involved, that you lose a little bit of time having to reorient yourself every time you're at a new station, as it were, that, you know, someone walk up the sink, you know, you sort of get into a rhythm, and that it cuts down on the actual time from shuffling around the kitchen, doing it the way, the second way. Okay, so that's one thing. Another reason that the specialization allows for a higher productivity of labor is automation. So here what I mean is that we know that the people can build machines and various types of tools and things, and so it's easier to integrate those if we break a job up into smaller tasks, right? Because you can't make a robot or an android that replicates everything a human being can do. But what you can do is make a machine that can do a very specific task. And obviously, over time, machines are getting more and more capable, and they can do more and more general things. But still, the point is, the way you integrate a machine into a productive process is you come up with a very specified task that people could do often, but that they don't need to do now because we have a machine doing it. All right, so that's that's one of the reasons that productivity rises with specialization, is because it's a lot easier to use automation in that process. Going along with that, sort of related, I mean, just to give you an idea that if you were gonna use a tractor to help in agriculture, it wouldn't make sense to do it unless there were a few people who focused on doing all the farming, right? If everybody grew his own food in his backyard, there would be no role for tractors. You might still have fertilizer and stuff like that, or, you know, little handheld, what do you call those, hose? Like little or shovels, whatever. You know, little things. I'm a little lost with what that thing is called. You know, something that a person could do individually, that might make sense. Those things could be produced. But nobody is going to take the time to make a huge tractor if everybody just grows his own food. It wouldn't make any sense. But what does make sense is if a few people focus on growing all the food, well, then, yeah, they can use tractors. Okay, so that's, an added point in terms of these five things. Where would you put that kind of thing in? I guess here under automation. And it also would be partly a number three here, economies of scale. So economies of scale is just sort of a general point catching some of these other things, but I just want to discuss it separately since it's so important. So what we mean by economies of scale is that if you double the amount of inputs going into something, you more than double the output. That's what it means that there are economies of scale, that there's a more than proportional increase in the output when you increase the inputs. So the simple example, everyday example I gave for that, I think, in the textbook was if you're making coffee or dinner, that somebody's getting up and saying, hey, I'm making coffee, does anyone else want some? Why do people do that? Well, one thing is just for courtesy, right? It would be weird if you had people over your house and said, hey, I'm going to get up and just make some coffee for myself, and you're sitting there sipping the coffee, you never offered it to your guests. That would be weird and rude. But beyond that is the fact that it's, if you're going to go ahead and I know some of you guys might not drink coffee, but you can watch your parents when they do it, it's the time it takes you and the hassle of making a cup of coffee for yourself to make more than one cup of coffee, you know, a full thing of coffee that can satisfy four coffee drinkers, it doesn't take you four times as much effort, all right, that you just have to put in a little bit more coffee and some more water, and the extra time it takes you is about 30 seconds. So that's why it's so obvious that if you're going to get up and make a cup of coffee for yourself, you ask people, does anyone else want it? A different example, again, for those of you who are going off to college, you'll notice it there that when people, sometimes roommates, you know, if they're going to make dinner, will switch on and off, right? So that if you have two people living in an apartment and they take turns making dinner, the reason they do that is that if you're going to go ahead and make a meal for yourself, you're going to bake some chicken or something, that's going to take you an hour. You got to get the chicken breasts and you got to marinate it or do whatever the seasoning is, put it in the thing and put it in there and turn it on and cook it for an hour. Whether you want to make one chicken breast or two, it doesn't take you twice as long, right? It's basically the same preparation, and you got to pay for getting the second chicken breast. But the point is, a lot of what goes into making a hot, steaming chicken breast for dinner, it doesn't take you twice as much to make two of them, right? And so that's why if you have a roommate, it makes a lot more sense for you guys to take turns cooking dinner for each other. So like I cook the dinner on Monday, then you cook it on Tuesday, I cook it on Wednesday, rather than every night each person making dinner for himself. That would be wasteful. Okay, so that's the idea. Number four, natural aptitude. So here, this is obvious. The part of the reason that the division of labor works is some people just naturally are better at some things than others. And so obviously, if that's the case, you know, if you're trying to understand why is it that if some people focus on being lumberjacks and other people focus on being brain surgeons, that we cut down more trees and we have more successful brain surgeries, well, part of the reason is there are some people that are just naturally kind of big and burly and they can go chop down trees, and other people, you know, are really smart and they can study a lot and learn about various parts of the brain, and they have very good hands, you know, very steady hands. So they can, you know, operate and use a scalpel and make very precise incisions and so forth. And that you probably wouldn't want to swap those people. You wouldn't want someone operating on your brain who makes a good lumberjack, and somebody who makes a great brain surgeon probably isn't going to be able to not cut down too many trees. All right, so and the last point here is practice, practice, practice. That one of the big things is, in addition to everything else I've said, when people specialize and go into their own occupations, they gain experience over decades of work. And so, you know, now when you ask, gee, why is that brain surgeon so much better at doing brain surgery than that guy over there who's a farmer? Part of it, yes, is that the brain surgeon, you know, had the aptitude for it, had steady hands and so on. But another reason is that brain surgeon went to medical school and then did his internship and residency and then maybe, you know, has been doing brain surgeries for the last 20 years at this hospital and goes to conferences. And, you know, when somebody dies, you know, has experts come around and they try to figure out what did we do wrong and that kind of stuff. Okay, so that person has just a wealth of experience and training going into it. And so that's part of the reason, in addition to all this other stuff we're talking about, that person's more productive. Okay, so again, for all these different reasons, you can see why when we specialize and go into various occupations, the productivity of labor goes up. So that means everybody is producing more stuff, so there's more stuff to go around. Now, one thing I didn't mention so far in the presentation, I stress it in the book, is in order for specialization to work, you have to have trade, because you need people to be able to make way more than they personally need in whatever their industry or occupation is, and then they trade the surplus with each other. So the only way it works, for example, if you're going to have some people specialize in growing all the food and other people specialize in making all the houses, and some people specialize in making all the clothes, that only works if they all trade with each other. Because if they don't trade with each other, well, then the people who make all the food can eat, but they're naked and standing out in the rain, and the people who make all the houses are sitting in a nice, cozy place to live, but they're starving and they're naked, and the people who make all the clothes are starving and outside, but hey, they have a nice parka on. Okay, so you get the idea that the productivity of labor only matters, it only works if people specialize in what they're really good at, make a ton of stuff, keep what they want to use, and then trade the rest of it away. Okay. The last slide, and then I'll turn over to your questions. I just want to explain this chart to make sure you're getting what's going on here. So this is talking about comparative advantage. So traditionally, when economists talk about comparative advantage, the context was international trade. And we are going to get into that later on in the course when we talk about tariffs, which are taxes that governments impose on foreign goods. All right, so again, historically, this notion of comparative advantage, it was developed to explain why nations gain from trading with each other. And that even if you had one nation whose workers were more productive at everything, it still made sense that that nation was richer if it could trade with some other nation whose workers were worse at everything. And the reason was this issue of comparative advantage, because what happens is the country that's better at everything focuses on the things that it's really good at, and the country that's worse at everything, it focuses on the stuff where its deficiency is the smallest, and then there's more total stuff made, and so they can trade and raise the standard of living of people in both countries. Okay, so again, we'll focus on that issue later on. What we're doing right now is just showing, even on a personal level, this issue of comparative advantage works, and we see the benefits of specialization, the division of labor, and trading with people, even on an individual level. So here, what's going on in this numerical example is, the story behind this is there's this woman, Marcia, who owns a store, a clothing store in the mall, and she, what she does, she spends her time trying to convince customers to buy, right? So she's out on the floor helping people, you know, talking about the clothes and, you know, making chit-chat and saying, oh, that looks great on you, and, well, have you considered doing this, or what about putting this belt with that? Oh, you look great in that. You know, she does that kind of stuff. But then when at the end of the day, if it's just her, she needs to shut down a half an hour early because it takes her that long to clean up the store. You know, she's got to move the clothes around. Like, if people have been trying stuff in the fitting room, she's got to go hang that stuff back up. She's got to take the garbage out, wash the floor, whatever, so that the next day she can start fresh with a spick and span looking store and, you know, do the day again from the start. So the issue is, does it make sense for her to hire John, who's going to come in and maybe help her with her operation? And what these numbers in this table show are the various times it would take for them to do these chores. So what you see is, you know, tidying up the store at the day's end to do all the tasks, like put the clothes back on the proper shelves and wash the floor, take the garbage out and that kind of stuff, clean the windows if people have been, you know, little kids have been leaning up against the glass and putting their tongue on it, whatever. That would take John an hour to do all that stuff, whereas it only takes Marcia a half an hour. And so you might think, just looking at that, well, no, why would Marcia hire John to do that? Because, you know, he's worse at that job than she is. She could do it herself much more quickly than hiring John, so why would she possibly do that? How would it benefit her to mix her operation with somebody who's so clearly unproductive compared to her? You might think that, but then you look at the other column and you see why. Because John is awful at trying to convince customers to buy, right? He's not very good at all at that. He doesn't know the clothes. He has a horrible fashion sense. He's awkward socially. You know, he doesn't make eye contact and so on. So, you know, it would take him 2 hours out on the floor on average to get somebody to buy something, whereas it only takes Marcia 15 minutes on average. And so you see, look at these numbers, the reason it could help Marcia to hire John, even though she can do everything better than him. She can sell clothes better than he can, and she can even clean up the store better than he can, because he's just, you know, a goof-off teenager, let's say, and she's real serious and, you know, boom, 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 and gets the stuff done. Still, it makes sense for her to hire him, or it can make sense, because what happens is, even though she even though he's worse at both tasks, his deficiency is smaller in tidying up the store day's end. And so what happens is Marcia can hire John to do that, and that frees her up. So even though it takes him an hour to do what would take her 30 minutes, still, if she hires him and he's out for an hour cleaning up the store, that frees her up, and so now she has an extra 30 minutes that she otherwise wouldn't have had, and in that 30 minutes she can make two sales. Okay, so that's the idea, that we're, it's just a matter of trade-offs, and the issue is by hiring John, Marsha's valuable labor can be redirected into doing something else, where her advantage over John is even more pronounced. So the way you looking at this, the way you would know if I said what task does Marcia have the comparative advantage, the way you would look at that is you'd look at and say, okay, well, she has a 2-to-1 advantage in tidying up the store, but she has an 8-to-1 advantage in convincing a customer to buy. So relatively speaking, her advantage is in convincing a customer to buy. And if I say, in this example, in what task does John have the comparative advantage, you would say tidying up the store at the day's end. All right. So Marcia has what's called the absolute advantage in both. But the comparative advantage means like the relative advantage. And so John actually has the comparative advantage in tidying up the store. All right. So in the book, I gave you an example of maybe how much John earns per hour, or how much he charges per hour, I should say, and how much Marcia can make on a sale, just to put numbers there, and you could see why it makes sense for her to hire John, how she makes more total money doing that. All right, but again, the general principle is the reason very skilled people can benefit from interacting with people who are less skilled is that it frees them up. Other classic examples that economists give are like a lawyer or a dentist or a doctor having assistants. All right, so let's say there's a lawyer who's a really good typist. The lawyer still might hire a secretary or an executive assistant to type up legal forms and to, you know, prepare paperwork and stuff like that, even though the lawyer could do that stuff faster. But the reason is the lawyer, by outsourcing it, if you will, to some hired help to go type up all the forms and deal with paying the bills and all that kind of stuff, the lawyer then can take his or her hours and just focus on dealing with clients and stuff that they can bill to clients, as opposed to taking up an hour a day filling out paperwork and things like that. Or, you know, a doctor, you know, when you go to a doctor's office, what happens? Most of the time you're in the doctor's office, you're not dealing with the doctor. First you deal with the receptionist, then you go back and someone comes and takes your blood pressure and weighs you, and, you know, what's the problem, writes down stuff, and then the doctor comes in and spends like 5 minutes with you. All right, so why do they do that? Well, it's not that the doctor isn't capable of sitting at a desk and saying hi when someone comes in and, here, please write down your insurance information. And it's certainly not that the doctor doesn't know how to take your blood pressure and weigh you. It's that would be a horribly wasteful use of the doctor's time. By having the system that they do, where the doctor hires receptionists and, you know, nurse practitioners or whatever you call those people to take your blood pressure and everything, that means now the doctor's day. I mean, you're not seeing this from the patient's point of view. You're just knowing you're sitting around the waiting room, where the heck, and then you're in the inner room waiting for the doctor, and he comes in and sees you for 5 minutes. What you're not seeing is there's plenty of patients like you all throughout the clinic, and the doctor's going, boom, seeing somebody for 5 minutes, boom, seeing somebody else for 5 minutes. And so the total volume of patients who go through there is much higher because the doctor's only spending 5 minutes per patient. All right, so that's so it like leverages the doctor's ability so you can get more patients through there. And the same thing with the lawyer. So that's the idea. That's how comparative advantage manifests itself on an individual level like that. All right, so I'll stop there, and let me check the questions for the professor week 4. So remember, if you've got questions for me, just go ahead and post them at the Moodle site on week 4. So we've got about 20 minutes left in this section. Okay, Ed Farr says, is my thinking sound? And then he outlines a scenario. There exists a class of workers with pitifully low skills and aptitudes. In a free market economy, everyone's life is constantly improved by innovation, yet this class is comparatively unaffected because the prosaic goods they buy improve more gradually than other things. Governments are powerless to improve their lot. Though willing to accept handouts, many can't or won't change their lives, and the government programs are typically counterproductive. Outside of a few success stories and a few private rescue efforts, this is as good as it gets for a certain population. Okay, so sorry, I thought you were setting up this hypothetical scenario and then you're going to ask me a question about it, but it looks like you're saying, isn't this true? Isn't this true of the real world, that there are this class of workers with low skills and aptitudes? I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, in a relative sense, yeah, I think it's always going to be true that in a free society, that, you know, some people are going to be overachievers and some people aren't. But if you're asking if we had a totally free market, would there be this group that just languished and was on the verge of starvation or something? I mean, it's no, I don't think that's true. I think a lot of what we recognize as people being caught in a cycle of poverty or whatever you want to call it, an underclass or lower class or whatever term you want to use, that a lot of that is due to bad government programs that set up bad incentives. And things like, you know, obviously welfare payments that sort of keep you dependent on the government, that you're getting, in a sense, I mean, people characterize it and say the way the government, at least in the United States, I'm not sure how it is around the world, but in the United States, in a sense, young mothers are paid to not have jobs or husbands, because you get more money from the government in terms of support if you have a bunch of kids and you're not working and you're unmarried. Because if you get married and your husband, you know, I think that alone causes a reduction, especially if your husband has a job, then you got income. If you go and get a job, well, now your income goes up, so you're eligible for less help. If you have fewer kids, you're eligible for less help. So you see the pattern there. So even though defenders of the program would say, well, no, I mean, if somebody has more kids and they don't have a job and they don't have a husband to support them, of course that poor young mother, you know, needs more help, and so we have to send her more money. You know, that's understandable and that may be true, but on the flip side, you know, looking at the incentives there, that it's not surprising then that there are people who are caught in poverty over generations. And then, so it's things like that. Also, government schools, I think, especially in, you know, inner cities, are awful, and that if you had a free market, that those, you know, the kids who wanted to go to school and whose parents made them go to school would receive much better education than what happens right now. And then the drug war, and we'll talk about that later on in the course, I just think devastates certain communities, especially, you know, poor people who tend not to have much political power and who are in large urban areas. I think, you know, drug gangs and so forth and what the police do in those areas, that's very devastating, and it's not such a big deal if you're in the upper middle class living in the suburb, that you don't really see the devastation of that. Also things like rent control and public housing. I mean, those, if what you wanted to do was to inculcate a whole group of people that didn't fit well into the labor force and were dependent on checks from the government, the system the governments have put into place, at least in the Western democracies, is pretty good for creating that kind of environment. So what I'm saying is, I don't, if what you are saying is that you think that it's just natural and there's this large segment of the population that's always going to be on the fringes and, you know, sort of there as a ticking time bomb or something, it's hard for us to know because we can't see what the world would be like if we got rid of all the stuff I just talked about, but I don't think we can conclude that there's lots of reasons, lots of things that the government does right now that I think distorts social outcomes. Okay. Somebody's asking about the Ron Paul thing. I'll come back to that if we don't have any other questions, but let me ask in response to these other questions. So James Carmody says, will you explain what on the margin means? Yeah, sure, that's a great question. So when we say thinking on the margin or engaging in marginal analysis, what that means is, and that's a very economistic thing to say, first of all, it means that you're looking not at the whole class or the whole set of things, but just at the unit that's on the edge, right? The unit that you're thinking about acquiring or that you're thinking about getting rid of. And so when you say, why is it on the margin, meaning like think of a book, where are the margins? They're on the edges, right? So the margin's not the whole interior of the page. It's just the edges of the page. So that's like the mnemonic to jog your memory as to what do we mean when we say on the margin. So thinking on the margin means that you make decisions based on the actual changes that are going to happen because of the decision, the things that are going to, you know, the units under consideration. So the classic example is the water diamond paradox, that when someone comes up to me and says, hey, do you want this gallon full of diamonds or this gallon full of water, and I choose the diamonds, on the one hand, that looks sort of odd because, well, gee, isn't water more valuable to you? Isn't it more useful than diamonds? But that's not the issue. I wasn't choosing between all the water I'll ever have access to in my life versus all the diamonds. I was choosing on the margin that of those particular units. So that was, you know, under normal circumstances, really that was like the 3,000th gallon of water compared to the first gallon of diamonds. And so, yeah, that first gallon of diamonds is more valuable to me than the 3,000th gallon of water. And so that's what it means to think on the margin. See if I can give you a different example. Let's see. Okay, so I'm trying to sell my house, and I have a high mortgage payment, okay? And then we had a trouble there. We couldn't find a buyer, right, because it's a bad housing market. And so then I considered renting it out. And so I was asking the people, like there's various people that come in, because I don't want to be a landlord. So there's people who come in services, and they take care of that for you. So you're still the owner, but you don't deal with vetting clients and stuff like that. And if a pipe bursts or something, you know, you don't have to go over there and fix it. That this company does that for you, and they collect the checks and all that stuff, and they obviously take a cut. So the issue was, you know, how much can we rent this place for? Now, some people, you know, and a guy said a number that was lower than what my monthly mortgage payment was on the house. And so some people would say, oh, well, then it's not worth it to you, right? That it's not a good deal. Why should you rent that house out if you're not taking in enough money from your renters to be able to pay the bank your mortgage payment every month? You should just live there yourself. But that's not the issue. Thinking on the margin, what the correct answer is to say, could I rent that out, and then could I go and myself live somewhere else and pay lower monthly rent in my new place than what my tenants are paying me to live in the house that I still own? Because if that's true, well, then I have more money on net every month. And so the point is, you know, thinking on the margin, the issue is, you know, the check I have to send to the bank every month because of my mortgage, that's not changing. Whether I rent the place out or whether I stay there, that check is the same. So that's not an issue. The issue is just on the margin, what's going to change if I move out and have tenants come in. And again, so if the tenants come in and pay whatever, $1,500 a month, and I can go rent another place for $1,000 a month, well, then I have an extra $500 a month than I did before. Right, so that's kind of an example of thinking on the margin and trying to isolate what's actually changing based on your decision. So now there too, that wouldn't be the only consideration, because presumably it's nicer to live in my house than it would be to live in some apartment for, you know, that for a lower rental payment. So, I mean, you'd have to consider those things, too. You'd say, well, I have an extra $500 a month, but we'd live in a smaller place. Or maybe, you know, it's further away from the shopping or my office or whatever. But you get the point. Like, when you're making a decision, you have to isolate what do you, are you actually going to change by what you're going to do. And that's, you're looking at the costs and benefits of the things that are actually going to change, not everything else. So you're just looking at what's going to happen on the margin. Okay, back to the questions. And I'm refreshing the page in case any of you posted something new. It looks like not. Ed Farr says, is it possible to issue personal bonds and sell them on eBay? I don't know. I'm guessing not, but I don't know. If anyone else knows, you can chime in the public chat. I've never heard of somebody doing that. I think part of the issue would be in terms of your reputation. Like if you buy a gold coin from someone on eBay and you send them the money, it's pretty straightforward. Are they going to send you the coin or not? You know, if it doesn't show up, then you report them to eBay, and then they get a bad rating and all that kind of stuff. If they send it to you, you look at it, yep, that's what they said they were going to send me, and fair enough. But if you bought a bond from somebody, then, you know, like if it was a 5-year bond, technically, you know, you'd have to, it would take 5 years for you to be able to figure out the person fulfilled that end of the contract. So I'm guessing eBay wouldn't want to get involved in that kind of stuff, but I could be wrong. Okay, Jeffrey Carl says, it's kind of a long question, but it's the last one that's pending here. Hi, Professor. I watched Ron Paul's congressional hearing on YouTube, and there were obviously some criticisms of the Austrian school. I honestly didn't feel that the conversation overall went all that well for the members of the Austrian school, not because the Austrian school was incorrect, but just because the structure of this type of debate doesn't allow Austrians to expose fallacies in logic as they're being spoken. This inevitably seems to lead to Keynesians building these intricate debates that stand on a foundation of nonsense, which then lead to partial truths. For example, it was mentioned that in a period of deflation, both prices and wages would fall. This was said to be bad because the value of people's debt remained the same nominally, which means its relative value would increase. Let me stop this for a second. This is obviously not something's going to be on the midterm or whatever. So if you're watching this and you're concerned that you don't know what he's talking about, you know, don't worry. It's just this is the last question, so that's why I'm feeling it. Okay. However, this gentleman failed to mention that the relative value of your savings also increased in the time of deflation. In the debate, Mr. Clay offered what seemed to be the typical criticism of the Austrian school. Being that you aren't bound by the structure of a congressional hearing, how would you respond to this criticism of the Austrian school? I understand the Keynesians produce charts and graphs, and then as a science of empirical data, Keynesians don't get much further than the hypothesis stage. I guess my question is, when, if ever, does Austrian economics depart from the theory aspect of economics and become a more concrete science, as Mr. Clay claimed it was not? Okay, so just to give you the background in case you guys don't know what he's talking about. Ron Paul is now the chairman of the subcommittee under House Financial Services, the subcommittee that oversees monetary policy. And so that's the subcommittee that oversees the Federal Reserve. And so it's kind of funny that Ron Paul is now the head of that subcommittee since he's not Ben Bernanke's best friend. So Ron Paul had his first hearing now that he has that new chairmanship last week, and Tom DiLorenzo was the leadoff witness. And what they were talking about is the topic was the Fed and unemployment. And so they were, Ron Paul and his two witnesses, Tom DiLorenzo and Richard Vedder, were testifying that the Federal Reserve's policies caused the boom-bust cycle and lead to high unemployment. And so one of the people on the other side, one of them was this guy, Clay, I think his first name's William. He was a representative from, I think, St. Louis, but I could be wrong. and he, Democrat, and hated what everyone had to say, and so he starts railing against DiLorenzo, who's an Austrian economist. And one of the things he brought up was that, you know, you Austrians, you don't believe in empirical observation. You don't use the scientific method the way other economists do. You're just thinking of stuff, you know, off the top of your head and theorizing, and you don't ever go out in the real world and test your theories. So why should we believe anything that you're here testifying, since you guys don't practice science the way other actual economists do? Okay, so that's where Clay was coming from, and that's what this, what the question's about. So to answer that, I mean, it's, I still think it's true, and that's why I stress for you guys in this class that at the principles level, it's wrong to think that what the way you do science and economics and understanding basic economic laws or principles is to come up with a hypothesis, then go look at the data and see whether your hypothesis fits the facts. That if that's the model you're using, you're just going to get all screwed up, and that's not what's going on. That in fact, good economists, they derive their principles and their framework for interpreting economic reality through logical deduction. Okay, so what happens, what were we talking about? Oh yeah, so in terms of principles, basic economic principles, I think it's correct to say, no, it's logical deduction, and that's what the Austrians do, and that's what I teach you in that textbook, that again, you just wait and see, but as we go through the chapter, I mean, so far, right, I haven't pointed you to empirical data to make the case that I'm trying to make for you guys. Now, to understand the relevance of something, you know, you have to have some practical experience. Right? A Martian who was reading my textbook might think it was nuts. So, I mean, we're not... It's not truly divorced from reality the same way like a geometry textbook a Martian could understand, assuming the Martian's mind worked the same way ours did. But the point is, it's, you know, I'm just sort of relying on your intuition and going through it, and we're really using your knowledge of the world to sort of guide us through the discussion. You can see what's worth our while to focus on. And it's not really so much that we're proving things by looking at empirical observations. Okay, so but now having said that, it's true on certain higher level things that economists might argue about. Well, then you can't just do it all from deductions. So we can, and again, this is getting a little advanced, so if you're in seventh grade and you're just tuning in to learn about economics, don't worry if this is a little bit beyond your grasp, but I'm just answering the question. If economists are arguing about what caused a particular business cycle, or, you know, why is it right now that unemployment is so high, and what should the government do about that, if anything, well, there it's more complicated, because we can go over, and we're not going to do it in this class, but in the textbook, I think it's the last chapter, I lay out a theory of how the market economy might go through a business cycle and what causes booms and busts, or, you know, periods of prosperity and then recessions. I go over that in the last chapter of the textbook, but the point is, there it's, we can spell out a logical story, something that makes sense, just using deduction and just, you know, common sense and talking about how markets work, applying our principles. But in order to know in reality for a particular episode in history, that story we just told, is that what just explains what we just saw? That, you know, you can't know that kind of thing without looking at the real world, without looking at the data, as it were. Because again, the, you know, so to give you an example, I mean, it's a general economic principle or law is going to be something like, if the price of a product goes down, other things equal, people will want to buy more units of it. And we don't need to go test that. We can just develop that, and we're going to do that in subsequent chapters. And I'll show you where that law or principle comes from. And so, you know, we can even build up a thing saying, if the Federal Reserve lowers interest rates, that's going to cause entrepreneurs to do such and such, and that will lead to distortions and so forth and cause them to have to lay people off. But that doesn't mean now when we're asking why are all these people unemployed right now, we can't just say, oh, well, it's because we have this story over here. Because I could tell lots of stories about what would cause people to get laid off. If the government all of a sudden announced 100% tax, then a lot of people would get laid off. If the government said, we're going to go around and shoot employers in the head if we find that they have employees, well, a lot of people would get laid off. You know, if there was a rumor going around that certain people had communicable diseases and that they would transmit it if they showed up at the workplace, a lot of people might get laid off. You see what I'm saying? There's all kinds of stories we can tell that are internally consistent about people getting laid off. So if we're trying in reality to explain a particular historical event, then it's not enough just to rely on your general principles. You have to, you know, look at the data and see which of these principles applies in this case. Okay, so that's why. So anyway, we're out of time here. What I would suggest, Jeffrey, if you want to understand, like, how do Austrians grapple with Keynesians, go to my archives at Mises.org. And there you'll see in my discussions with Paul Krugman, I'm not just reasoning in terms of logical deductions from the fact that human beings act. I'm going and looking at the construction data, and I'm looking at housing starts and stuff like that to try to show that Krugman's arguments are wrong empirically. Okay, so we got to stop there. So remember, take your quiz this week, and then next week, so not this week, but then next week, there's going to be a midterm. So if you want to get an early jump on that, you know, start doing your studying now. Okay, thanks, everybody.